It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, finding the Bible. Every now and then, some thing comes along, an object like a clay tablet or an old scroll. It's dug up in the desert or discovered in an attic, and this thing that's been buried or lost for centuries sheds completely new light on beliefs and stories we've held for millennia.
No. What did he say?
He's going to destroy the world. Not be averted.
Man corrupted his world and filled it with violence. So we must be destroyed.
A great flood is coming.
We build a vessel to hold the innocent.
Mother! What is them?
What do you want?
Did you really think you could protect yourself from me in that?
It's not protection from you.
I have men at my back. When you stand alone and defy me,
I'm not alone.
It's the latest incarnation of a story that's been told for more than 2,000 years, Noah's Ark. Biblical scholars say the story is actually much older, that it predates the Bible and can be traced all the way back to an ancient Babylonian flood story. So enter one of those objects, a 4,000-year-old clay tablet written in an ancient script called cuneiform. It turned up at the British Museum recently and made its way to curator Irving Finkel, who just happens to be one of the few people in the world who could read it. And here's the thing. This dusty, pre-biblical piece of clay turns out to be a recipe for building an ark. Irving, let's start with the basics. What does this thing look like?
Well, okay, it's kind of brown. It's about the size of a mobile phone, and it's made of clay. Now, let's imagine this. You have a piece of clay, that shape, size of a mobile phone, brown, unbaked, on the floor. You get a chicken, you make the chicken drunk, and then you put the chicken on the tablet and allow it to dance to a 78 record. Then you have something which looks exactly like a cuneiform tablet.
Well, so for those of us who don't know anything about cuneiform, give us a little tiny primer. What's wonderful about it?
Well, the ancient Sumerians and Babylonians who lived in what we call Iraq, but what is anciently called Mesopotamia, these were the people who used cuneiform writing as their normal writing system. And they did it for about 3,000 years. They lived in a country where the riverbanks were lined with extremely high-quality clay, which could be used for a myriad of purposes. So when the first experiments in making marks which would enable people to recapture the sounds of the words that they wanted to communicate, they naturally turned to clay as a writing material.
So they just kind of engraved on the clay, drew on it with a stick or something?
They kind of printed. They wrote with a stick, a bit like a chopstick. And all the cuneiform signs, of which there are many hundreds, when you know how they work and what their sounds are, if you pronounce them one by one, you suddenly find the words leap out and you can hear the voice with these ancient sentences.
Well, into this story comes, in the present day, a single tablet with ancient cuneiform writing on it. And the backstory of how this tablet even got into your hands in the first place is extraordinary.
It's quite a romantic thing, really. We have lots of these cuneiform inscriptions in the British Museum, and I'm one of the two lunatics on the staff whose job it is to read these things. But on this particular afternoon, the young chap, Simmons, his name was, Douglas Simmons, he came in with a sort of bag of bits and pieces, miscellaneous group of small antiquities. And he said to me that his dad had been a bit of a curio hunter and in the late 40s was in the Middle East and he picked up bits and pieces. Now, the other stuff on the table was quite sweet and interesting, but it wasn't anything like as important as that tablet, because that tablet turned out to be part of the Babylonian story, the Noah-type flood story, with a lot of new stuff.
But one of the points of your book is that this story predates the Bible, right? So that there's a story about a boat and a flood and a rescue in, well, how far back?
Well, it's a good millennium before the Bible, a good 1,000 years, that these old ancient peoples who lived in between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers in Mesopotamia, they also had this story. And in their world, the gods decide to destroy the ancient Mesopotamian people because they were noisy. And I see it, I can't get out of my mind, this idea that the gods are sitting around after a heavy lunch, dozing in armchairs or something, and there's a tremendous noise somewhere off which keeps making them wake up. And eventually Enlil, who's the chief god, loses his temper and decides, look, I tell you, we're going to swap these mosquitoes, we're going to get rid of these people. It's really annoying. And when that afterwards we'll think about some other kind of species. But one god only, called Enki, he made up his own mind that this flood was stupid. So he found this fellow Atrahasis, the equivalent of our Noah, and he told Atrahasis, build this boat quick, fill it up with the animals, and everything will be fine. But this new piece from Douglas was something absolutely superlative, and it was the most astonishing thing in the world to read this for the first time, because the boat, the ark as we call it, they just called it the boat, was a round vessel. There was a special kind of boat, which we call a coracle, made of reeds or some such stuff and waterproofed, a round boat which was very light and was very safe because it wouldn't sink.
So this is basically like a giant basket.
So it is exactly like a giant basket. But the thing is this, in this story, what we have here is a giant coracle, but it's not a giant coracle like a storyteller would say, you know, 100 miles long and 6 miles high, or the biggest coracle you ever saw. The measurements are given for the rope out of which the basket is to be woven, and the wood to make the ribs, and the bitumen to waterproof it.
So basically it gives you instructions for building an ark?
It does. It's a bit like this. You go down to the supermarket, you get a big cardboard box to build a swing in the garden, and it has instructions on the side. You know, you should have 12 screws, one base, one seat, one chair, stuff like that. And then there's a diagram which is supposed to explain to you how to put it together. Of course, they never worked, those diagrams. This didn't have a diagram, but it had all the specs.
Why would the ancient Babylonians bother to write down the specs for building an ark? Is that so somebody could build another one in the future?
That was my first question. What is this stuff doing in a story? So I tried to imagine a context in which that calculation, and actually it was rather complicated calculation, had found its way into the narrative. And I had this idea as follows. Let's say you have a storyteller who makes his living, so to speak, going from village to village, and he's got this marvellous story about the near destruction of the world. If you focus for a moment on the likely audience in such a context, where you're going to have many people who were boatmen, who were boat builders, who lived by the river, you can't say to people like that, talking about rescuing the world, just build a big boat. Because someone at the back is going to say, what did this boat look like? Some guy, beefy fellow who spends his life, what do you mean? How big was it? What does it look like? You know, how big was it? And all these kind of questions. So what does he do? I have this idea that after some evening of embarrassment, he goes around to see someone he was at school with. He said, listen, I need to know, if we had a coracle that was this big, how much rope, can you work it out? You know, so probably the guy said, are you kidding me? So he go to the school, and then the teacher might get someone who made these, but maybe they'd have to do a lot of work. But in the end, they came up with the exact measurements. And then, so I think, well, I can imagine this guy goes into some village sometime, and he's, you know, they get to the pin about, can you tell us a I can certainly tell you about this boat. Now, let me be exact about it. The ground plan measures 3,600 square metres. The walls are 7 metres high. The amount of rope required is this, and so forth. And if anybody asked him this question, out it would come to defend his narrative.
Do you conclude from this, then, that Noah's Ark never existed? Because, you know, there are archaeologists still hunting for it on the slopes of Mount Ararat.
I know that, and I feel sympathetic towards them, but I don't believe Noah's Ark really existed, or the Babylonian one. I think there were real floods. I think in Mesopotamia there was once a disastrous flood, very, very ancient times, which left people with a residual fear that one day this tsunami could come back. And I think that the story of the Ark and the rescue of livestock is something which was created and became part of their mythology as the answer to that fear, with this point, that if the gods ever decided again that they were going to do this, there would always be some little rescue that meant life would go on. I think that's the relationship between them. In the Middle East, there must have been a massive destructive flood, and that generated the story in which escape by this special boat was the only answer.
Irving Finkel's book is called The Ark Before Noah, and he has one of the best job titles we've ever seen. He's the assistant keeper of ancient Mesopotamian script, language, and cultures at the British Museum, and curator in charge of cuneiform inscriptions on tablets of clay from ancient Mesopotamia. To see pictures of the tablets we've been talking about, visit our website, ttbook.org. Now, if you've been following, to the best of our knowledge, the last few months, you know we're collaborating with Sipur Israeli, or Israel Story. Some people call it the This American Life of Israel. It's now entering its second season in Hebrew. It's one of the most popular radio shows in Israel, and especially now, with so much depressing news coming from that region, it brings stories that try to humanize and also complicate things. Here's Israel Story's host, Mishi Harman, with a story he produced for us.
We always think that fake and real are opposites. You know, if something is fake, by definition, it isn't real, and vice versa. But, well, the story of Moshe Moses Wilhelm Shapira shows us that sometimes reality is just much more complicated than that. I didn't know it when I began researching the story, but the Shapira affair, or Shapiromania as many of the people I talk to call it, continues to stir up really intense emotions, even though it took place more than 130 years ago. Case in point, Micha Shagrir, a Jerusalemite filmmaker.
I'm following for many, many years. I am like a secret detective. Every day I think about him, or I do something that is related to his story. I go with him everywhere, and he is with me in the archives, in the libraries, in Europe, in Israel, in Australia.
Without a single exception, when I called all the people I talked to for this piece, collectors, professors, curators, archaeologists, documentary filmmakers, and told them that I wanted to talk about Shapira, they had the exact same response. Oho, Shapira? You have no idea what you're getting yourself into. And when I showed up at their houses to record, everyone, but everyone, asked me to wait a second, and appeared a few minutes later holding a stack of heavy folders full of pictures, newspaper clippings, articles, books, and documents bursting out from every side.
You want to see the objects of Shapira? I will show you. Here you see one of his heads. Here's the scrolls.
And here, for example, a photograph of Miriam, his daughter, and that's Rosetta, the mother, and that's Mr. Shapira himself, the only picture of him that I found till now.
It became completely clear to me that the Shapira affair was very far from being settled. So what are we talking about? In 1855, Moshe Shapira, a good Jew from an Orthodox family, left his home in the little Ukrainian village of Kamenets-Podolsky and set off on a long journey with his grandfather. They were going to the Holy Land, where, rumors had it, the Messiah was about to make an appearance. En route, somewhere in Romania, the grandpa died, and Shapira started mingling with all kinds of types. Most of them were representatives of an organization with a really catchy name, the London Society for Promoting Christianity Amongst the Jews. They promised him, with all their might, that the Messiah had actually already come, and that his name was Jesus. Moshe was slowly convinced, and when he arrived in Jerusalem a year later, he was a Christian, and his name was now Moses Wilhelm. In Jerusalem, he joined a small community of Protestants and converted Jews.
My name is Rechav Rubin, and I'm known by most friends as Buni.
Buni's a professor of geography at the Hebrew University.
Well, there was in Jerusalem a group, kind of a social community of European people. Some of them were missionaries, others were scholars who were involved in the study of the history of the Holy Land.
But Shapira wasn't really interested in the mission, or, for that matter, in research. He wanted to be a businessman, so he opened up a small souvenir shop in the Christian quarter of the Old City in Jerusalem. Irit Salman, a true Shapirologist, who even curated an exhibit about him, explains.
Well, he had one of the first shops of antiquity in Jerusalem. So he sold everything which he could to the tourists. He sold Bibles, he sold dried flowers from the Holy Land, which the German pilgrims liked very much, and memorabilia from any kind. And he sold, as a matter of fact, the illusion that they touch history, because they grew on the Bible and on the New Testament, and all of a sudden they hold in their hands something which maybe also Jesus Christ kept it. So it was very, very strong.
In addition to those kinds of souvenirs, which still fill the shops of the old city, Shapira also began selling antiquities that Bedouins from the area found and brought to him. His shop was a huge hit, and he became one of the best-known merchants in town.
It was a very famous shop. It was even written on the front of the shop that he is the representative of the British Museum, not just a regular shop. In the Baedeker tourist guide from the 19th century, it was written that this is the best antique shop in Palestine.
Shapira's life, as we say in Israel, was dvash, all honey. He married Rosetta, a devout German nurse. They had two girls, Augusta and Miriam, and his business was booming. And then, one hot summer day in August 1868, a discovery made in Divan, east of the Jordan River, changed his life. Local Bedouins had found a large basalt stone, inscribed with markings that sort of looked like footprints of a chicken. Shapira rushed to see the stone, as did another archaeology enthusiast, a young French diplomat by the name of Charles Clermont-Ganneau, who would, very quickly, turn out to be Shapira's arch-nemesis. It seemed odd to the Bedouins that all these distinguished Europeans were so excited about the rock and were fighting amongst themselves over who would pay a higher price for it. They were sure it had to contain some valuable treasure inside. So, one night, they rolled the stone into a bonfire, poured cold water over it, and smashed it to smithereens. They were pretty disappointed. The crazy Europeans, it seemed, had been fighting over a plain black rock. No treasure. But Clermont-Ganneau had had his aide copy the inscriptions before it was smashed. And when he deciphered the lines, it turned out it really was a treasure. The 34 lines on the Meshas Stili, that's what they call the stone, described a series of wars between the king of Moab and the Israelites. The exact same war described in the second book of Kings. Now, that might not sound super exciting today, but this was one of the very earliest external, independent accounts that verified a biblical tale. The craze around finding archaeological proof of the Bible began. Everyone wanted Moabite artifacts.
Very soon, a tourist guide, Arabic tourist guide, came to him after he opened the shop and made him an offer he couldn't resist. He said, "Whatever you sell to the tourists during the day, I can complete during the night," which means to make fakes.
Here's Buni Rubin, the geographer.
Well, we don't know for sure. I can only make a guess that if the demand was going up and up and up, and buyers could offer a lot of money, and they had a fairly low ability to assess the authenticity or the quality of the antiquities, then a businessman like Shapira wanted to have enough stock in his shop in order to supply this demand for antiques. So I guess if he couldn't get enough antiques from proper sources or kosher pieces, then it may well be that he thought how to supply this demand by producing or actually faking them.
Shapira saw the Moabite letters on the Meshas Stili.
And very soon in the market started to appear clay pieces with unknown letters that nobody could read, which means he created a new culture. It's called Moabitica. He liked it very much, and he started to get from the Bedouin who used to cross the Jordan and to bring all kind of antiques, part of them authentic.
Almost overnight, Shapira's collection of Moabite clay artifacts became famous all over the world. Articles were written about it, new theories were based on it, people said the collection was priceless, and Shapira himself became a major celebrity within the antiquities world. But if you look at Shapira's fakes today, even if you know nothing about archaeology, they look like something that a fifth grader made in an arts and crafts workshop.
Today, when we look at those pieces, it looks so clumsy and so unprofessional. All the sticked letters or the sculptures of head of people from stone, from clay, they look so strange because nowhere there are pieces like that or heads like that or pieces of archaeology like that. That's why it was so easy to sell those objects, because today, if you look at it, I look at it, not professional, we would say, this is a fake. But at that time, nobody knew it, so nobody could identify it. Everybody wanted to believe.
And Shapira totally took advantage of that willingness to believe. In 1873, he convinced the Archaeological Museum in Berlin, the Altes Museum, to buy 1,700 pieces from his collection.
For those who were skeptic, he invited to come with him to an expedition, and he took them to the desert or to Transjordan, and the Bedouins prepared for him in advance the area where he used to take them, as if they are going to excavate. And they just scratched the ground and they found pieces of pottery and archaeologic remains, and he prepared the visit very, very well.
The only problem with Shapira's pieces was that they were, we've seen, completely bogus. But even today, there are people who don't exactly see them that way. Uri Katz, a collector of Shapira fakes, for example, has a soft spot for Shapira, as kind of an original maverick or biblical outsider artist or something like that.
The artifacts that he was selling were really something new. It was not a copy of anything which we knew before. Shapira or whoever made the artifacts were some people of some originality, because they invented the artifacts. They invented the shape and whatever. He created something new in some way.
Micha, who we heard at the very beginning and who is in the middle of shooting a documentary film about Shapira, basically agrees.
No, he was not a chronicle swindler. He was not a real swindler, but yes, he had his tricks.
Of course, the man who proved to the experts in Berlin that these were all fakes was none other than Shapira's biggest rival, Clermont Ganneau, making him a polarizing figure among the Shapira underground. Some adore him. Others actually told me, and this is a quote, that they despise him. In any event, once the forgery was discovered, Shapira and his collection became sort of a laughingstock. He returned to his shop and to the simple, silly souvenirs. A few years later, Shapira came out with a declaration that immediately rocked the entire world. He claimed that he held 17 parchment scrolls inscribed with an unknown version of the Book of Deuteronomy, the final book of the Torah, written in an early Hebrew script. Perhaps these were the original scrolls that Moses received from God, he hinted. Or maybe a version written down at the time of Jesus by a retiring sect in the Judean desert, where, he said, the Bedouins who brought him the scrolls had found them. Obviously, this was huge. The Book of Deuteronomy, maybe Moses' own personal copy. But there was one even more mind-blowing surprise. Here's Micha, the filmmaker.
In the book that Shapira brought, there are 11 commandments. What is the 11th? Do love your friend as you love yourself. Love thy neighbor. What does it mean? Is it a very Jewish version, or is it a very Christian version?
He toured all of Europe with his scrolls, and you gotta understand, this was front page news in all the biggest newspapers around the continent for an entire year. The whole world, it seemed, was following the saga of Shapira and his precious scrolls.
He brought it to the German, and the German, as you remember, bought already 1,700 fake pieces from him. And after a few months, they thought about it and they decided not to buy it. And then he came to the British Museum. They believed him. The British were very excited from it because they loved the Bible.
Two of the scrolls were exhibited to the excited public, who queued up for hours to get a peek. Even the British Prime Minister, Gladstone, came to see them and tried to help raise the funds.
The sum of money he asked was unbelievable. Million sterling in 1883. Today, it's also a lot of money, but then it was, whew. In fact, he said to his daughter before he went to his last journey, "When I come back, you will be the richest girl in the world."
But then, of course, our French friend, Clermont Ganneau, rushed over from Paris.
Despite the fact that there was no tunnel and no fast train, but it was fast enough from one day to the other. Clermont Ganneau came, he looked at the scrolls, and then he said, this is forgery.
And then they come back to him and say, "No business. We found your past. You are a forger. We even checked the text and the scrolls themselves. A forgery."
It's the most chutzpedik fake in the history.
Yes.
The British press was wild. The story was everywhere. They didn't stop to write about it day and night in all the newspapers.
The English got cold feet, and they told Shapira, "Sorry, we don't take the scrolls."
Even for a tough survivor like Shapira, this was a really hard hit.
He went from place to place, from country to country, all over Europe, and in March 84, he arrived to a small hotel in Rotterdam and committed suicide.
And what happened to the scrolls that caused a worldwide frenzy and were nearly sold for £1 million?
The scroll afterwards was sold in a fair to a collector who bought it for 16 sterling. And they say that his library was burned and they were never found.
End of story? Well, not exactly. A little more than 60 years after Shapira killed himself in that Rotterdam motel, disgraced, humiliated, and penniless, a Bedouin shepherd, Muhammad Adib, was out grazing his flock near Qumran in the north of the Dead Sea. When one of his sheep ran into a cave and wouldn't come back, the shepherd threw a little rock which hit something that made a strange sound. That's how the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Exactly in the same area where Shapira claimed that the Bedouins had found his scrolls. A new, completely horrifying possibility emerged. Could it be that Shapira's scrolls, that were maligned and destroyed, were real after all?
To be really honest, there is a small, a tiny, like this, what if? And what if these pieces, which are lost now, were not faked? What if part of them was authentic? Then we lost something which might have been very, very important. How can we know? How can we ever know how to deal, how to work out this tiny little what if? The tiny what if, I think, will be an open question for forever. We'll never know. And the what if will stand, I guess.
In one final ironic twist that only a forger like Shapira would really appreciate, his fakes have now themselves become very valuable collector's items. In fact, today people talk of real Shapira fakes. and that's what Irit Salman called her exhibit about him. Truly fake.
I think it's a great name. In English, it's truly fake. And in Hebrew, Ziyuf Amiti, because it was really fake. So it's a real fake.
And who knows? Maybe somewhere in a backroom workshop of a souvenir store in the narrow streets of Jerusalem's bustling Christian quarter, someone right now is sitting down and making fake Shapira fakes.
Mishy Harman is the founder, producer, and host of Israel Story. You can read about Mishy and listen to more of his pieces on our website, ttbook.org. And if you like them, be sure to tune in to Israel Story's first season in English on the Vox Tablet podcast beginning August 18th. I'm Anne Strandchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. So far this hour, we've been talking about the controversies that can erupt around biblical artifacts. And one reason this is such a heated field is that it's not just history at stake. It's theology, too. What people believe, who they pray to, and how. For example, take the Nag Hammadi texts, also known as the Gnostic Gospels. They were discovered in 1945, buried in the Egyptian desert. 52 texts, scrolls, written by the followers of Jesus. They're full of beautiful and cryptic sayings and poems attributed to Jesus himself, but they are very different from the Gospels that have been canonized in the New Testament. Scholars are still sorting them out, among them Elaine Pagels. She's been slowly unraveling the theological implications of the Gnostic Gospels. Here's her conversation with Steve Paulson about the Gospel of Thomas.
It begins with the words, "These are the secret sayings which the living Jesus spoke, and Judas Thomas wrote them down." So it's just a list of sayings of Jesus. And in this gospel, the question, "Who is Jesus?" is answered in saying 77, in which Jesus says, "I am the light that is before all things. I am all things. All things come forth from me. All things come back to me. Split a piece of wood, and I am there. Lift up the rock, and you will find me." So this just suggests that Jesus is a kind of voice for the divine energy, the light that was in the beginning, according to the book of Genesis.
But that's very different than Jesus saying he is the Son of God.
Well, it is. It is. And according to this text, which has a great deal in common with the other Gospels, the good news, which is what gospel means, is you too come forth from that light. Because in this text, there's a saying in which Jesus says, if they say to you, "Who are you?" say, "We are children of the light." And if they say, "Where do you come from?" say, "We come from the light, the place where the light came into being in the beginning." And the message of this text, the good news, is that from that divine source, all beings come forth, not just human beings, but rocks and stones, everything that is.
Now, you make the case in your book, Beyond Belief, that the Gospel of John was then written to counteract this message of Thomas.
I was very startled when I realized that. You know, having read the Gospel of John for, you know, I've read it before, like many, as many of us have. And I suddenly realized that this gospel, which sounds like it's Jesus declaiming, you know, he's saying things like, "I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life, I am the light, I am the divine," know? And according to the Gospel of John, the answer to the question, who is Jesus, is he is the divine sort of in person. The bad news, of course, is that you and I are not. Hmm. And according to John, the good news is that you can be saved from dying in sins if you believe in him.
Now, I suppose the implications of these two different interpretations of Jesus could be enormous. I mean, on the one hand, in the Gospel of John, there's the message, Jesus is God, but in human form. I mean, Jesus is the one and only, whereas Thomas
That's right.
is saying that, well, Jesus is the light. It's not nearly so specific as putting Jesus up on a pedestal. And I suppose it raises the question of whether Jesus is divine at all.
Well, you know, the Gospel of John also uses the image of light. I mean, Jesus says in chapter 8, I am the light of the world. But you got the critical point, which is that John says Jesus is the only one, right? And the one word that the Gospel of John is always using for Jesus, and only the Gospel of John will say, he is the only Son of God, the unique Son of God. The Greek word means the only unique, one of a kind. And the point of John saying that is to counter the kind of teaching that says, all beings come forth from the same source. Now, it may not be obvious that we have the divine image in us. You see, it's not the same as saying we're all God. I mean, that would be pretty almost trivial. But what it says is that humans are made in the divine image, and the divine image is understood to be this energy, this light energy. And so it says that that divine source of energy is hidden within all of us. What we need to do is discover it.
Now, I suppose these must have been pretty important questions in the first few centuries. I mean, before Christianity was accepted in the Roman Empire, before Constantine became a Christian himself, because Christians were persecuted then. And so how you define a Christian must have been incredibly important.
It was very important for the movement, and so much so that many leaders of the church, you know, wrote massive attacks on people who taught this kind of thing. And it doesn't work very well for forming group boundaries, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to build a church, you don't teach that everyone has the divine light within them. You might instead say something like, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to God except through me. And that means that if you want to find your way to God, you better go to Jesus. And if you want to go to Jesus, you better go to the local church that teaches that kind of thing.
And I suppose if you are a persecuted minority, it does make sense to establish clear boundaries so that you have a solid sense of your own identity.
That's a very important point. You know, I realized it's not some kind of conspiracy theory that leaders of the church were trying to stamp out the free thinkers. But they were in a situation of trying to have the movement survive, quite simply, under enormous and horrendous pressure, seeing their friends tortured and imprisoned and executed for the sake of this faith. And so the question of how do you consolidate it? How do you make a formula that everybody can agree on, a sort of simple litmus test, you're in or you're out? And the Gospel of John does that very well.
Well, suppose the Gospel of Thomas had been included in the New Testament, that this was part of the Bible that we have read for the last 2,000 years. Would we interpret the story of Jesus very differently? Would we think about what it means to be a Christian differently?
I don't know. It probably would be, as the Gospels are now, a kind of collage of several pictures of Jesus put together, you know? What it would do is open up the path of seeking and searching yourself within yourself to find spiritual truth in the way that the Gospels we have now often aren't read to do. I mean, often the Gospel of John, for example, says, you know, you believe this and you'll be saved. It doesn't say, go out and discover for yourself the truth. It says, all truth is revealed in Jesus. We witness it. All you have to do is believe it. You may have no evidence, but you have to distrust your own experience and trust our witness. And I think that's a great, I think it's unfortunate that the emphasis on spiritual discovery is not encouraged as it is in the Gospel of Thomas. More often, it's closed and shut, and people are told that their own experience doesn't matter. They should just sort of shut up and believe it.
Elaine Pagels is a biblical scholar and one of the foremost experts on the Gnostic Gospels. She and Steve were talking about her book on the Gospel of Thomas. It's called Beyond Belief. We're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll change the subject. Comedian Marc Maron joins us to talk about comedy, depression, and the late, great Robin Williams. I'm Anne Strainchamps. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, Bookmarks, writers on books they love.
My name is Samuel R. Delaney. I'm the author of Dahlgren and Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders. And the book I'd like to recommend is Charles Olson's 1947 study of Moby Dick called Call Me Ishmael. It's a wonderful literary performance in itself. Even though it's a piece of criticism, it reads like a poem. It also has a thesis, and the thesis is that Moby Dick is both a celebration of industry in America and the particular industry that he sees Melville being interested in is what he calls one of the most amazingly efficient machines ever developed in this country, and that is a full-blown whaling ship. And he gives some reasons to bolster this notion that indeed the whaling industry in the middle of the 19th century was an incredibly important industry that made many, many millions of dollars for the people who believed in it. And at the same time, it's also a critique of American business. He wants to show how it will talk about the way in which this business was self-destructive, and that under the authority of a captain like Ahab, who has made his own personal vendetta the center of the enterprise, he is going to destroy an entire ship full of sailors. And not only that, destroy an entire ship full of sailors with their own consent and drag them down to a watery grave at the end until only one is escaped alone to tell thee. The book could be the first of the Maximus poems that eventually Olson spent his life writing, this incredible collection of major poems, and it's written as though it was the opening of the Maximus poems. It deals with the same notions, the notions of space, the notion of the American frame of mind, both in its positive ways and its negative aspects as well. And it does it in a very, I found, a very, very convincing way. It's the kind of thing that makes me want to get back and start writing myself again, which is one of the reasons I like it so much.
Pioneering science fiction author Samuel Delaney with his recommendation, Charles Olson's 1947 literary criticism classic, Call Me Ishmael. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. Like you, we were shocked and saddened this week to hear about the death of Robin Williams. He was such a brilliant, zany, even manic performer. But Williams also had a gentle side. And it shone through in a conversation he had with fellow comedian Marc Maron a few years ago. This was on Maron's WTF podcast. So here's Steve Paulson's conversation with Marc Maron about the inner lives of comedians and the sadness that often haunts the best.
Now, the episode that really put you on the map was your conversation with Robin Williams. And this was not the usual Robin Williams that we've heard, sort of that, you know, hyperdrive manic Robin Williams. He was actually pretty laid back and real. Can you tell me about that interview?
Well, you know, he's a pretty sweet guy when you hang around. He was always, oddly, fairly accessible when you run into him at a comedy club or something, and you sit and chat with him. If there's not too many people around, he's almost shy and very sweet. And I think that once he agreed to do it, you know, I drove up to his place up in the Bay Area. It was 11 in the morning. It was at his home. There was no one there. It was just the two of us with two microphones. And I don't think that there was anyone really to perform for. And I think he was at a point in his life where he'd had a relapse on alcohol. He'd had heart surgery. You know, he was looking at some darkness. And, you know, he'd gone through a divorce. And there was a vulnerability there that I certainly understood. And I think that he was ready to talk about and to talk about it in a candid way.
You know, you've had all this stuff, and that, you know, there really is a certain degree of, like, it doesn't matter.
Big time.
It just doesn't matter.
That's the kind of the freedom, the ultimate freedom of letting go in a weird way. Like when you talked about all the stuff, you know, the shit that they say about you. I know it's out there, and it used to be, it would immobilize me. And now
it would hurt your feelings.
Oh, it hurts everything. You're just going to go, well, I shouldn't perform. Then going, no, you love performing. Go out and perform. People will say good things. People will say bad things. It's the nature of the world. It's like you say, it's like Tina Fey once said, if you're ever feeling really good about yourself, there's this thing called the internet. Now, at this point in your life, going on stage, being around people you have a good time with, and seeing people like Pearl, seeing people like Overton, and hanging out with friends, and you go, oh, God, and hanging with you, even when we're at the Comedy Cellar, going upstairs and just riffing, go, that's worth it to me more than worrying about, oh, how am I doing?
You know, it almost sounds like some of these podcasts kind of function like therapy. You know, people getting stuff off their chest and for some reason telling it to the world, at least those people who follow you, gets rid of something out of their deep black box.
People come to it with different expectations. Some people are willing to talk. Some people want to talk. The Todd Hansen episode around this type of conversation that you and I are having was really the most profound as an event. And I think a lot of times...
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, Todd Hansen was really the original head writer of The Onion for most practical purposes. He was there at the ground floor, you know, comes from up in your area.
Right.
I'd known him for years, and I'd always liked him. We didn't talk much, but, like, we were all in the same circle. And I had scheduled an interview with him in New York. I was there for a few days doing a live WTF in Brooklyn. And I said, look, let's do an interview. Let's do this. Why don't you meet me at my hotel? So Todd comes over to the hotel, and he basically says, yeah, I've been to this hotel before. And this is off mic. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, I came here, and I checked in, and I had no intention of checking out. So off mic, I said, well, what are we going to do here? Are we going to talk about this, or what do you want to do? And he goes, I don't know. So we did the interview, and we talked for an hour about The Onion, about its impact, about, you know, where it came from, where he came from. And at the end, he just said, look, maybe we have more to talk about another time, but I really appreciate, you know, whatever he said. I'm paraphrasing. So that was the end of that interview. And I just kind of held on to it. I said, look, you know, if you want to talk about this, the other thing, we can do a second part to this. And he's like, okay, I'll think about it. So I didn't put up that first interview. I just held on to it. And a few months later, you know, he said, I think I can talk about it. So I said, okay. So I met him at his apartment. And he, you know, he walked me through that day and those feelings and the repercussions of taking that action and how it affected him and others and how he felt now. And I posted those two together. Now, what we talked about, though, that you wanted to make sure that we talked about...
I just wanted to say I'm sorry to all those people. I mean...
About the selfishness.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, I talked about this a little bit, that I had left this note saying, oh, you know, I'm really sorry. But that wasn't good enough, you know? It's a selfish thing to do, to take people's love and not give it back, you know? And if you abandon them, then all of the investment of love that they gave you is, you just transmute it into pain, and it's not fair to them. So, I mean, not only do I thank all of those people, but I also apologize to them. I mean, I've said this to all of them many times, and they're sick and tired of hearing it, to be honest, but I just thought it was important to say, not only thank you, but I'm sorry. And it will not happen again.
And that had a profound effect on me, on hundreds and hundreds of listeners who sent emails, who had dealt with that, those feelings themselves, or had family members that they could never understand how that family member could do that or try to do that. And it just shed a lot of light in a very intimate way on a profound, horrible human reality that is completely selfish and mysterious to people that don't have those kind of feelings.
Now, we started out by talking about where you were when you first created WTF. I mean, you know, your life was a wreck at that point. Is it fair to say that comedy has saved your life again?
Absolutely. It saved my life in a very unusual way. You know, the pride that comes from creating something successful and taking some risks and earning a little money from it is something I never have experienced before. And to feel like you've earned your money and that you've earned your success is something I never thought I would feel. I was washed up, buddy, and that's a reality.
Hmm. So given what you've been through, I'm wondering if you have any advice for people, comic or not, whose life has bottomed out, about how to climb out of that pit.
Well, just realize that you can be disappointed, but what's important is that you're alive, you're healthy, you got people that love you and depend on you, is to not ruin all that because you think you failed.
Comedian Mark Maron talking with Steve Paulson. You can hear the extended interview on our website. And we only played a bit of that extraordinary conversation Mark Maron had with Robin Williams. The full thing is really worth listening to. You'll find the link on our website. Robin Williams' unique brilliance is gone, but he left an extraordinary body of work behind him. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show, with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Raymond Tungekar. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.